This is Wastoids.
Hello, everybody. It's the Spindle Podcast with Mark and John.
Welcome to The Spindle, a podcast about 7-inch records. I'm Mark.
I'm John.
And in each episode, we talk about one 7-inch record, hopefully give you some insight into it that you haven't heard before. We both got into music in the 80s and 90s when 7-inches were super important, especially on independent labels. So that's the era we mostly draw from. But we sometimes pick some stuff earlier or later than that, too. And either way, we try to keep it short and to the point, just like 7-inches do. On this episode, we are talking about ESG's You're No Good, backed with Moody and UFO, released in 1981 on Factory, the UK label. Though on the record itself, it says Factory / 99 Records co-production deal. It later got expanded, well, not much later, almost at the same time, was expanded into a 12-inch EP by 99 Records in New York when they put some live stuff on the flip. It was recorded in the fall of 1980 by Martin Hannett, producer, at a studio in East Orange, New Jersey. And the lineup for the single was Renee Scroggins on vocals, Deborah Scroggins on bass, Valerie Scroggins on drums, Marie Scroggins on percussion and vocals, and Tito Liebren on percussion. So this is an interesting one because I think most people know ESG for that EP that 99 Records put out, which is a 6-song EP. It's got, on the flip side, it's got 3 tracks from a concert they played in late December, I think in December of 1980. But this actually came out first on Factory. ESG was a got to open for A Certain Ratio when they were over here, and they were on Factory already. And I guess Tony Wilson, the Factory guy, who people might know if they don't know much about Factory, if you've seen 24 Hour Party People, he's the main character of that movie. But he saw them play and immediately said, let's make a record. And like within a week of that show, they went into the studio with Martin Hannett, the same studio that A Certain Ratio had recorded at. And initially we're supposed to just put down You're No Good and Moody. But I guess Martin Hannett was like, there's 3 minutes left on the tape. Do you want to try something else? And they had this song UFO, which ended up being the kind of the most well-known or notorious song from this because it's been sampled in hip hop and other music like billions of times.
Yeah.
And ESG became their big claim to fame for a long time was the fact that they'd been sampled by everybody and got no compensation for it or no renown for it. And they even had an album or a single, I think, called Your Sample Credits Don't Pay Our Bills. Whatever. So that tune is the one that became sort of the most famous, but they're all awesome songs. And the background with this band is they're all basically formed by sisters. 4 out of the 5 sisters in this Scroggins family put a band together, and they were living in the South Bronx. And their mom was a single mom, I think. And, you know, they were scraping by, but she somehow managed to save up enough money to buy them instruments. And most of them were still in high school when they started playing. I think Renee, the singer, is kind of it was her main idea to put everybody where they were in the band and start writing songs and stuff. But, you know, they were happening at the tail end of No Wave and the beginning of disco, but they were pretty much isolated on their own in the Bronx. And they happened to go to some contest CBS Records was doing that was like a talent show. And for some reason, Ed Ballman of 99 Records was at this. And they didn't win anything, but he was like so into them. He said, I'll manage you. I'll record you. I'll make everything happen for you guys.
What made them be so minimal? Like just circumstance, like they had a bass and no guitar kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, well, yeah, that's part of it. I think part of it is they, cause I think early on they were trying to play covers and they weren't doing so great on the covers. At least Renee didn't think they were. And she's like, at least if we write our own songs, people won't know if we mess them up, or not.
The classic. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I think they have a little bit of almost like a Shagsy kind of thing to them. Although they obviously were more competent musicians and had studied and been, you know, given lessons and things like that. But I think that they were kind of isolated in terms of like their, well, they had a lot of influences, but I don't think
they're playing disco basically. It's just like an extremely stripped down disco. Cause it's interesting. It's always interesting to me that one of the things that gives them their unique sound is a lot of dance music now sort of post that era is on the one kind of, you know, whereas this is very much on the two, very much more like the pulse beat of disco. I'm sure they're influenced. There's a Latin music influence obviously in there as well.
For sure.
Very obvious one. And probably also the minimalism of hip hop. I mean, could that be something too? They're just at that point, hip hop was just usually a drum break and somebody yelling over it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that must've been part of it being in the Bronx in the late '70s, early '80s. I'm sure they were hearing that. I mean, I've read stories about them hearing a lot of Latin music just coming into through the windows. So that's part of it. They were big James Brown fans too. I think one of the quotes from Renee that circulates a lot is she loved the bridges in James Brown songs. She's like, why can't we just play a bridge for entire songs?
That's how genius does it, you know?
Yeah. And I think also they were, I don't know, I haven't heard them say this, but I think they were pretty well aware of, you know, we only know so much about how to play. So instead of trying to make super complicated songs, let's just play what we can play and try to find value in that, which is, I mean, these songs, the minimalist, like you say, the stripped down aspect and the repetitive aspect all lead into that. But they also obviously figured out how to make that sound great.
Were they aware of any... Because they're definitely contemporaneous with a lot of very similar shit happening in England. I mean, A Certain Ratio is just another, you know, a great example of just two things arising in almost the same circumstances, completely divorced from each other. Were they aware of that stuff at all? Like, were they aware of punk and new wave? I mean, I think I remember reading they're very aware of dance music at the time. But I wonder if they were aware of more popular forms of new wave and stuff like Blondie or things like that. Were they into that kind of stuff? Or
I think they definitely knew about it because they were playing the same places like Hurrah and Danceteria and stuff. So they were crossing paths with those bands. And then this whole event of them being asked to open for A Certain Ratio, I mean, they got in with Tony Wilson and he took them to the UK and stuff. And so I think they pretty much soon after that clued into a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, obviously they developed. But at that point, sure, yeah.
I think even before then, they probably did.
It's also just shooting fish in a barrel to think that Tony Wilson would like that right. music. Like it's, right. I mean, that's pretty fortuitous that, you know, somebody like him or the 99 Records guy, like the both of those just randomly, they could have played that music for years in the Bronx at parties and everybody just be like, oh, they're kind of nice, but randomly gets totally. In front of a couple of those particular people and who are the perfect people to put it out there and exploit it in the best sense of exploit.
Right. Totally. And it comes at a really cool point in terms of like, you know, the no wave scene itself was kind of gravitating in this more, I mean, James Chance was getting into sort of a more dancey kind of groove aspect of his music. And then Bush Tetras were coming up and Liquid and bands like that. And then also the fact that especially in no wave, but even in new wave before it and stuff, they'd been pretty well established that your gender wasn't that important. I'm sure there were still biases and prejudices, but it was one of the more open scenes. And the fact you know, a band of five African-American women or four or five, however, whenever they played, they had different configurations, but was pretty well accepted right away is a pretty good comment on how things were going at the time.
Well, we've discussed this before. The early punk new wave scene was very gay, you know, in a lot of ways and accepting of that. And kind of one of the differences with the hardcore scene that came after is they felt that maybe it wasn't male enough. I mean, it's easy to sort of see that. So you're right. There was a door open there for a second where people did step through. Lots of great musicians established careers at that point and wrote songs that became popular and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And just the idea that the group of black sisters in the Bronx would be accepted right away by these guys who wanted to put out their records is a pretty good thing. I mean, I'm sure they encountered some resistances here and there, but it sounds like things went pretty decently for them given how it could have gone.
Yeah. Well, they had the goods kind of, especially for that kind of crowd, you know?
Yeah, totally. For me, the cool thing about this is obviously all three of these songs are by the same band. They're not wildly different, but they have different aspects in each one. I mean, there's you can hear some sort of soul ballady stuff in some of them. And then the UFO song is like, it's sort of amazing that it became the one that became sampled, because it almost feels like a sample to begin with.
Yeah, right.
The way it's constructed, it's so repetitive. And those siren-y sounds on her guitar, which apparently she said she was trying to mimic the sounds of Close Encounters of a Third Kind she'd just seen in the theater yeah. recently.
That's great.
It's interesting too, because you can totally place them in a position, like I was saying, with Liquid and Bush Tetras and some of these other bands that were playing kind of rock disco. But I also don't, and their samples went wide, far and wide, but I don't know that they influenced anybody in terms of anyone ever sounding like them. And I don't, not necessarily that they didn't influence anybody. I'm sure their story has, but I don't think too many bands figured out how to.
Oh, I think they influenced house music. They influenced house music, because back in those days, house music wasn't made by machines. It was made by drums, and there wasn't sampling then.
Right.
So it has to be played. So you have to put four on the floor, boom, 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 you know, boom, boom, the bass. So that's what they're doing. I think if you look, they're probably a huge influence on, I think any kind of minimal house is probably got more than a little of that ESG. Those songs, you were hearing them in clubs for ages afterwards, like dance floor fillers, eternal dance floor fillers. I would say in that sense, they're hugely influential. They kind of are a step in there. You know, New Order helped birth, like we're at the birth of house music. And it kind of seems to me that that's that ESG stuff sort of, they're coming off of that a bit, knowing it's on Factory, and maybe for themselves thinking, you know, we're almost like this band. Why are we not just doing haunted dance music like they are, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And I don't know that it's that direct, but it seems to me that that's what's happening at that time period. And then as the 80s wore on, you get more sequencers, samplers, and things like that. But disco was played by people, you know? Right. So any of the house music that was influenced by disco, which it all was originally played by people, then eventually sampled, then eventually machine made like it is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's also an interesting time period in New York, because really quickly, so no wave happens in mid to late 70s. And part of the reason it's able to happen is because all these artists can come and live in New York for nothing. They can squat in places, and they can take electricity from the light poles outside and stuff. And so, and go, you know, they're wanting to make art in rock clubs, basically. And then pretty quickly, not long after it had been kind of a completely abandoned city, developers swooped in and started pushing people out. But there's this little kind of hybrid time where you can still live there and make art relatively cheaply, but you can also get a crowd of people coming to the dance clubs and the discos and stuff.
Right.
And I'm not sure how much ESG benefited from that, really. In fact, they probably should have benefited a lot more, but it was kind of a cool time that disco could kind of flourish when it could be a trend without it being something that you had to have money to be involved in, which would change pretty quickly after that.
Well, and what they did is so reductionist that there's not a lot of artistic aesthetic room for movement there. Like,
right.
You're there. We've reduced it all, and it's great. But then after, you know, 15, 20, 25 songs, anybody would go, is there something else I can do? So I don't know what, I am not aware of, did they do anything after this? Like, what was the scene? Or did they just drop, that was it? Once this,
yeah, not much. I mean, they made a full album. They made, you know, like did exactly what you're saying, about 15 to 20 songs, and kind of collapsed after that. I'm not sure the reasons why they ended up not. I think, you know, a couple of sisters were always sort of trying to keep the band going. And they've had some resurgences in terms of,
well, I know they came back in the 2000s. They play that now they're out and about a little bit more, but
right. But the original sort of end of it, I'm not sure exactly how it happened. I think it sort of just kind of faded away. And I think, but I do think what your point is definitely part of it is that, you know, they either had to come up with some new things or they kind of made their statement, which was sort of a no wave trait too. I'm not sure that they were aligning themselves with like Lydia Lunch's projects and things like that, but that's what would happen with those bands. I mean, Lydia was pretty blunt about it being like, I have an idea. I'm going to make a band. We'll put out a couple records and that's it. That's the idea. I'm not going to try to do more of it. I expressed myself one time. And I think sort of not necessarily intentionally, but ESG kind of did that too. I mean, they came up with such a unique thing. And like you say, such a basic and stripped down thing that it was kind of, let's make our statement. And that's,
I'm hoping lawyers got involved and they're getting paid more now.
Yeah, that's something I also don't know too much about. I mean, I think they have in some senses, but
at this point, I think they're probably, because it's been used in so many. At some point, somebody tried to exploit it and it had to go back to them. You know, for a while, maybe people were able to steal the recording, but there reaches a point where the lawyers step in. Hopefully. I mean, I don't know who owned all the publishing in the first place and stuff like that.
Right.
Because Factory, of course, was notoriously no paperwork,
right?
So they would have just said, hey, we're putting out a record and that kind of thing. I don't know if they got a little more professional after a point, but
I wouldn't be surprised if 99 was kind of like that too.
Yeah.
Although they did do a Bronco record and he probably was more of a pain in the ass about getting contracts and stuff, but I'm sure ESG was not necessarily, I mean, they were teenagers, so there was only so much they could be expected to figure out.
Well, there's only so much money that's being made. You know, I mean, let's be honest, it's not like a top 10 hit. So,
yeah. 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 And the concept of sampling
later did not exist at the time. But nowadays, and how it would, it's been used in soundtracks, it's been used as full on samples. People rewrite it for songs, and it's kind of a different sort of property than when somebody's just biting that ying, 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 ying part.
Yeah, and I mean, everything's gotten more tight legally when it comes to samples. I mean, part of the reason those De La Soul records didn't come out again for a while is because they had to go back and either clear everything or replay it, have somebody replay the sample so they could use. Apparently, those new De La Soul reissues have like remade samples in a sense. So it's interesting that Martin Hannett, I mean, it seems like sort of just kind of the random fact of the fact that he was over there with a certain ratio and Factory was interested in them, that he would be the producer. But it's still kind of an interesting, I'm curious, I haven't found in any of the things I've read anything about what his sort of effect on it was. I'm guessing he kind of just let them do what they do because he wasn't super familiar with them. But there is, you know, through some of the things he did with Joy Division and stuff, there's a similarity.
Well, he did a lot of production because at that time he would have done it because I think he was still a partner in Factory and his role was to produce. Tony Wilson says, I want to make a record. Martin's going to turn it into a record. Now, Martin Hannett approached a lot of things a lot of different ways. You know, he produced the Buzzcocks. He didn't do much to them. It probably depended on what he got. And he part of Joy Division is, I think, unlike a lot of other bands, they came to him relatively unformed. And so that allowed him to sort of jump in there and form something. Whereas ESG, this sounds pretty formed. You would probably just be setting up the mics and being like, let's just get a good sound and, you know, make sure that, and give them creative space. Obviously, telling them do what you want for 3 minutes is fostering a creative atmosphere.
Right.
You know, rather than the kind of stories you hear about them using aerosol cans as hi-hats or disassembling the drum kit looking for rattles with the Joy Division guys.
I mean, the cool thing is that even whether, regardless of sort of how much control he exerted, I think he was a good match for just the way this comes out because
it's a great sounding. These are great sounding records.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's pretty stripped down, but it's got an atmosphere too. It's not just like dry.
No, he's perfect. He's a perfect guy for it.
Especially with the bass. I think her bass lines are the real reason that these songs work. I mean, I think the drumming's great too, and the whole package works well, but the bass lines are just so, that cool combination of sometimes machine-like, sometimes almost syrupy.
It's a lot of very simple melodic syncopation going on in their music, which just always works. Especially if you figure out a way to make everybody stay, like, probably having to make everybody kind of do their thing means that everything has a clearly delineated role, which means that the syncopation is more apparent and more catchy.
Yeah, I think so too. It's funny that last time we talked about the Kingsmen having played Louie Louie for 90 minutes.
Yeah.
I think part of the reason these songs worked in dance clubs, and maybe I wonder if they ever did it. I haven't read that they do, but it seems like you could play UFO for 20 minutes. You could play You're No Good for 20 minutes. I mean,
right. Well, that's what I mean is this is the beginning of disco and house, because a band like that, they would just stop singing and play and people would dance. And then, you know, you just do it until it looks like people are bored of dancing to it. And then you wind it up and start a new one. Yeah. You know, it's a more forgotten world. It's like, you know, people don't go out and dance to live music anymore. There aren't really live bands that are specifically for people to go out dancing. You know, it's probably the last echo of the big band era or something like that.
Right, right.
Totally. Where you'd be expected to play hours at a club. Like a wedding band would be the closest you'd get to that now. And nobody does that anymore. They hire DJs.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, it's kind of the simplicity is pretty heavy with these songs, and with they mentioned James Brown, the Supremes, Jackson 5. I guess Jackson 5 was actually a pretty big inspiration because they saw Jackson 5 on TV and they're like, hey, they're young.
Sisters. Well, yeah. It's also brothers. They're brothers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they would think, oh, we could be the female, you know, the Scroggins 5. I think all of us are that age. Remember that Jackson 5 cartoon in particular. But also, they were so big. I mean, Jesus, there's a great band. And the bass lines, you can definitely, they're both intricate and good and things that you probably can pick up on because it's pop music and kind of bubblegummy and not super complicated. Be a good way to learn certain kinds of bass lines.
Yep. I mean, she said she would watch Don Kirshner's rock concert and Wolfman Jack's Midnight Special and think we could do what they're doing up on stage.
Oh, my God. I feel so old. I feel so old when reading that quote, you know, 8 years old, 9 years old, watching those shows and seeing both just how terrible music was at that point. Like, right. You know, people have these foggy memories of the 70s and stuff like that because everybody thinks it's the Stooges, Alice Cooper. Right. And it kind of was Cooper, but it was, you know, it really wasn't. It was all the saddest crap you could think of, plus the Doobie Brothers, who are even sadder. And I remember sitting there watching those things going, man, there's got to be something else. Got to be able to do something else, you know? And I know I wasn't alone, you know? And it's funny to hear that sort of same sort of attitude watching these terrible long-haired brown, everything's like brown and suede and stuff. Uh-huh. And singing about their feelings. But it's interesting how it's almost like the Ramones in a way, like Moody is everything reduced down to a single word or more like musings about something rather than You Broke My Heart. It's the You're No Good. It's funny though that I say that. And then one of the things it reminds me of always is Linda Ronstadt has a song called You're No Good. That's basically 90% of it is her just going, you're no good, you're no good, you're no good, baby, right. You're no good. Over and over and over again, like the whole last third of the song, maybe. That might have inspired that also. You know, like you say, she was interested in hearing parts of song lock up and she's like, well, why can't that be for 20 minutes? Which is a very dance floor kind of concept and ended up being a lot of the concept of rave. Lockups like that would cause people to go nuts and have their ecstasy freak outs and blow their whistles and stuff. Kind of an early version of that. Maybe, I don't know, just speculating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also love, I mean, especially like with You're No Good, there's not many words in it. It's You're No Good and a few other lines, but it's, I think it was really smart of her to be like, this needs to match the music. The simplicity of music also needs to be kind of mantra-like. There was also a quality of like, I don't need to say much more. I mean, part of it is the voice is another instrument in these songs. And right. So distracting with a lot of different concepts or words would actually be counterproductive, I think, with the way the music works. It makes more sense for her to be thinking, I'm playing these five notes with my voice.
Right.
You know?
And it's funny, they're from Bronx and the Ramones are from Queens, and it's kind of a similar. Yeah. Both inspired by, you know, because Jackson 5 definitely bubblegum. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, inspired by sort of these respective kind of dissatisfaction of what they right. saw around them, even if they weren't seeing exactly the same things. The lyrics are, you know, it's like, I don't want to go to the basement, you know. It's moody. I'm moody.
That's funny. Yeah. If you sped up one of these songs and added a guitar, it might even sound like the Ramones.
Concurrent development like that's always very interesting.
It is really interesting.
How does that happen? And, you know.
Yeah. And it's interesting the perspectives of both those bands. It's not only, you know, what's going on now sucks and we want to go against it. It's also like we want to harken back to a time before when we thought the music was better. And we're translating it through our perception of what was good about that music, which makes it different than the inspiration. You know,
I've said that before. It was at least as somebody with a memory who's alive, one of the big parts of the punk new wave thing when it first struck was there was a thread in the mid-60s that was dropped, that there was a sense of innovation, of excitement, of energy, of intensity. And the idea that if you were going to make pop art, you had a responsibility to advance things. And that got lost. And a lot of those bands heard the band and deliberately dropped. I mean, literally like that, 1+1=, mm-hmm. and dropped all that like immediately. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are like, wait, what happened? You know, why is everybody got acoustic guitars and singing about their feelings? And, you know, I don't give a fuck about that. right. And so it's cool to see it happening sort of across, mm-hmm. like, you know, from my perspective, I'm a white suburbanite. There's a lot of people from my age group who kind of felt that same thing. It's cool to mm-hmm. see there's a version of it that was happening in the Bronx in a completely right. different milieu culturally, mm-hmm. you know, even with hip hop happening around them, they were still sort of like, there's something missing, something mm-hmm. else. And they were right. Because people are still listening to it. It was missing and it needed to be there, and it was there, and people were like, yes, thank you, we need this. So pretty cool.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I really, and this is a little bit of a side point, but I really love this quote that I found from her. She's like, we were making a sound on instruments we could afford. All the percussions we had, the claves, the congas, cowbells, tambourines, made it easy to incorporate Latin feel into the funk because it wasn't expensive. Man, I think that's another really cool thing about punk. That they don't get as much credit for. Their minimalism comes partially from let's do what we can with the tools that we have, you know.
It's work with what you have in front of you. It's very that's very inspiring to me as an artist. It's like, that's something I always strive to do. Instead of being like, well, I need this thing. I teach art now. And so one of the things I try to teach my kids is making art is as simple as just look around you. What do you have? You can create. So that's pretty cool that they, you know, and one of the best things, almost any artist you can think of, all the great artists took a restriction like that and turned it into a strength. That's kind of how you get into the open ground doing stuff that people aren't really doing mm-hmm. is by challenging in that way.
Cool. Well, yeah, this is a great one. And I'm really, it's funny. I think I've read it many times and I thought it myself since I started reading about it. They're really known for that EP, but this is their actual first record, the 7-inch, and it really works really well as a 7-inch. These three songs go together. They're strong, and
I love that it's on Factory too. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
It's really you know, if people talk, Tony Wilson is definitely somebody's less known in the US than he is in the UK. There would not be punk without Tony Wilson. He's a key player. He brought the Sex Pistols up north. He refused to ever act in any actual business-like way. He earned his money as a television presenter and then deliberately was like, I'm spending this money, doing it to create art, and mm-hmm. I'm a pop artist, and I feel like all art is ephemeral anyway. You know, mm-hmm. money's to be wasted. That's art too, wasting money, you know, and all of this kind of semi-situationalist, but also just a spirit of fun, thinking that that's a way to be creative. And very kind of underrated person. Most people just think of him as Joy Division, but really the Factory Records thing is way more than that, and has to do what with music, local music in Manchester, and how he tirelessly championed that stuff. So it's pretty cool that he picked up on local music, very local music someplace else, and championed that too. Right. You know,
And right away, without hesitating,
without even a bat of the eye, was like, this is what's needed. And it was right, you know, and so pretty cool.
Well, cool. Well, go find the single if you never heard it, and find all their other records. And we will hang out with you next time on The Spindle.
Cheers.
The Spindle is produced by John Howard and me, Mark Masters. I'm also the audio editor. Our theme song is by the great band Honey Radar. Our podcast is brought to you by Wastoids, audio and video from Hello Merch. Find more podcasts and videos at wastoids.com. And please leave a rating and a review of our podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks.